Hello, Channel 9. I'm going to talk today. We're going to have some fun with covariance and contravariance. Covariance and contravariance is a phenomenon that shows up wherever you have applied mathematics. One of the places we have applied mathematics is in physics, and another place where we have applied mathematics is in programming. Anybody who's grappled with covariance and contravariance in programming knows it's a bit of a slippery concept. It's a slippery concept for me, but I know it really well in physics, so I'm going to show you what it means to me in physics. My goal in this lecture is to be as clear as possible. I hope you know and remember a little bit of college calculus, but you won't have to know much more than that. But before we go on, let's take a minute to look at this gorgeous picture here, because there's something here that I need to motivate. This bunch of yellow stuff in the front, this is a cluster of galaxies. I believe this is in the southern hemisphere. The cluster has a name that begins with CT, which I think stands for Cerro Tololo, big telescope farm down in Chile. In any event, this is an enormously massive cluster of galaxies, and it is bending light. It's curving space-time around it, and you can tell because there are some blue galaxies behind it, and multiple images of the same blue galaxy shows up in multiple spots on this picture. I can point at it. You won't be able to see it, but look at the image here and see if you can spot this little blue galaxy shows up here, 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 maybe some other places, maybe over here somewhere. Same galaxy. There it is in the center again. The light, this blue galaxy is behind the cluster. The cluster is bending space-time, curving space-time. And the light from the blue galaxy is being bent around and showing up in your eyes in multiple different places. It's being turned around, it's being inverted, it's being flipped, it's being re-imaged in multiple ways. This is called gravitational lensing. It's due to the curvature of space-time by massive objects, and this is the connection to black holes. The mathematics for black hole physics, for curvature of space and time, has as an unavoidable phenomenon covariance and contravariance. I'm going to show you exactly where it comes from in this mathematics, and we're going to have fun with it. Later on, we're going to connect it to the same ideas in programming, or we're going to show that it's a different idea. So this, as I just said, this shows up in math, physics, and programming. We want to know, is covariance and contravariance every place it shows up an aspect of one bigger idea, or is it a special case? When it shows up in programming, is it one kind of covariance and contravariance? When it shows up in physics, is it a different kind of covariance and contravariance? We're going to find out. Now, another thing that's important is that this does seem to be a slippery concept. You think you've got it. Say, in the case of programming, covariance and contravariance has to do with subtypes in function arguments and return values. If a function can take an object as a parameter, then it's completely kosher to give it a string, because a string is an object. And if the function returns a string, it's completely kosher to assign it to an object, because a string is an object. One of them is the covariant direction, and the other one is the contravariant direction. Which is which? That's why it's so easy to get them backwards. Now, in the case of physics, I'm going to show you how you cannot get them backwards, if you think right. And then we'll figure out how it works in programming, too. So I'm going to start with the devil I know, which is physics. Just as I said. Maybe we'll look at some other math areas as we go along. Okay, what is this in physics? Covariance and contravariance shows up from an application of differential geometry on manifolds. A manifold is a curved space-time, a curved space, curved space-time, but they can be very pedestrian things too. Everyone knows an example of a manifold, and that is the surface of the Earth. It's curved. You cannot draw straight lines forever. They will eventually meet. You have to use this differential geometry on manifolds on the surface of the Earth in order to do calculations. It was discovered as a side effect of cartography when they were, you know, creating Mercator projections, all that kind of thing. They discovered this mathematics. And the same mathematics pumped up to four dimensions takes care of space-time, gravitational physics, black holes, and gravitational lensing. But interestingly enough, almost every other area of physics has been geometricized also, been rewritten in terms of differential geometry. Mechanics, electrodynamics, many areas in quantum physics, statistical physics, everybody's using these ideas now. They're immensely powerful. Differential geometry on manifolds is the most general way of doing calculus in any number of dimensions, even when the spaces are curved. And then finally, it won't be very long. In fact, this collider that quenched last year in Switzerland, the big CERN thing that's on the border of Switzerland and France, was supposed to have an experiment that could answer this question. But it looks like string theory or loop quantum gravity is going to seal the deal. That means that all of physics will be rewritten in these terms. But more and more pedestrian everyday life, GPS, you can't do GPS without general relativity, because satellites that are closer to the Earth, their clocks run a little slower. Can't do astrometry, can't do cosmology, can't do black holes. From the very mundane everyday positioning to the most exotic stuff in the universe, got to have this math. Let's analyze the words co and contravariance. Co and contra mean with and against. So they kind of go together. You cannot have one without the other. And Eric Meyer likes to call this an aspect of duality. Remember how this showed up in the I observer, I observable pattern. It's dual to the I enumerable, I enumerator pattern. Duality is everywhere. Is it one kind of duality being turned into different things, or is it multiple different kinds of duality? And then variance implies movement. Co and contravariance shows up when something changes. What is the thing that's changing? We're going to find out. My running example is going to be for you to imagine a flight path, and I just picked a couple of cities that were hard to spell, Reykjavik and Johannesburg. Now, I also picked a couple of cities that were far enough apart that curvature is unavoidable. You're not going to be able to do this calculation without taking account of the curvature, just as you won't be able to do calculations in black hole physics without taking account of curvature, because that's what black holes are all about. Space-time gets so curved that nothing can get out. Now imagine two functions. Remember I said something's got to go with something else? So we got to have two. A waypoint as a function of time and fuel as a function of waypoint. Let me show you exactly what I mean. Let's call this waypoint as a function of time, the flight path, P of T. I'm going to put this up here in our little inventory. Try to keep a running glossary. Path. And the other one is fuel as a function of waypoint. Now these are real concrete things. You could imagine a couple of tables so that you give it a time and it'll give you a location or point. At time T1 you're up flying over Belfast. Time T2 you're flying over Le Mans. Time T3 you're flying over Perpignan. Time T4 you're flying over Béjaïa, which is this place out in the middle of Algeria. And sure enough, over here we can go from Belfast and find out when we're flying over Belfast, the fuel we've spent is F1. When we're flying over Le Mans, fuel is F2, and so on and so on and so on. Now, they're kind of laid out like this for a reason, because if you've been hanging around Channel 9 for a while, you know what's coming up next. Composition. If you put these two functions together, you feed the waypoint as a function of time into the fuel as a function of waypoint, then you get fuel as a function of time. Two different ways to write this. You give me a time, I give you a waypoint. You take that waypoint, feed it into F, you get back a fuel. The entire composition is really a new function, which we'll write this way, of time that gives the fuel as a function of time. And this kind of equation can actually be viewed as a definition of the composition operator. The composition operator takes two functions that are compatible or commensurable, combines them, and gives you a new function. This is a new function. This is an input to the function. Together, feed an input to the new function, you get a value, and it's equal to this value, which we build up by the functions we already have, the tables we already have. Okay, now I hope you can remember some college calculus, because the most natural question is, what is the fuel burn rate? I really want to know, in a short amount of time, how much fuel do I burn? That means, remember your college calculus, I want df dt, the change in fuel for a unit change in time. Minute to minute, how much does the fuel change? And you'll remember the chain rule, which we just blindly write out like this. It's very picturesque. It's very easy to remember in this form because it looks just like you're canceling out terms. If this were a number, you'd be canceling out this number with this number, and the equation is trivially true. But I'm going to show you as we go on, this notation it's more than broken. We really want to live in this world of functions and function compositions, because we write something like this. It's completely unambiguous. You know that this guy is a function. It's a function of time. You feed the function of time, you get a value for fuel. You're looking at this stuff, you really don't know what it is. Is this guy, we know that f is a function. Is df dt a function? And if so, what are its inputs? And you can't tell from looking at the notation. The notation does help you remember the chain rule, but we come over here and we're even more lost. P is a waypoint. How can I calculate a df d Belfast? A df d Le Mans? I can't. I can't do a d Belfast d Le Mans. It doesn't make sense. The answer to the conundrum is you have to introduce coordinates. Coordinates are things that let you do calculations in curved spaces, in flat spaces, or whatever. So now we're going to go, just remember this. This is so easy to remember, who could forget? I'm going to introduce coordinates. Bold space, double strike x, bold face x. This is a function. So you give it a waypoint, and it will give you a latitude, a longitude, and an altitude with attitude. Give you all that stuff. Now we're going to define a new function. These are the guys that we will never get rid of here. Let's define a new function, f sub bold x, such that f sub bold x, I'm going to use the composition notation, composed with bold x is the same as f. Does this type check? Sure. X takes a waypoint on its right-hand side and it feeds it into this thing. So we're defining f sub bold x in terms of the thing we already have. This is a function that consumes coordinates as numbers, and now we can take derivatives. You have to have functions of numbers to take derivatives, because that's how calculus is defined. It's defined on these functions of real numbers that go to real numbers. Now, let's use our associative law. We remember, now I mean P not as a point, not as a waypoint, but now P as our function, our path function here. F composed with P, this has to be a function of time. And we already defined F in terms of F sub bold X, composed with bold X, the coordinate function, composed with P. That was the definition of F, you remember right here. So far this equality is obvious, and everything checks out. This is our path function. This whole thing is a function of t. This whole thing is a function of t. Everything's okay. Because function composition is associative, just take that on faith for this lecture, I can reparenthesize it any way I want. And I'm going to reparenthesize it this way. And I further declare I'm never going to separate the waypoints from their coordinates. Because although I can make tables and do searches and do function evaluation, I can't actually do any calculations that require derivatives unless I have coordinates. So I'm going to define this guy, this composition, is going to be x sub p. So we're now going to rewrite, and all this, by the way, is on the slides, which we'll hand out at the end, so in case you get lost, you can always look them up. This guy, f sub x, composed with X sub P is our new way of writing F composed P. It's the same result, always gives you the same fuel as a function of time. We've just gotten rid of the waypoints in a form where we can't do calculations, and we're always going to be working with latitude and longitude, and this is a guy that produces latitude and longitude, and this is a critter that consumes latitude and longitude. So we're in good shape. One of my composition symbols disappeared. But anyway, there we go. Now, let's still stick with the picturesque 19th century notation for a minute, because I want to appeal to your college math. The quantity that we want to compute is and this is, since we've established this equality, bold x compose x sub p dt. Now we can apply the chain rule and get some things that we can actually do some computations with. This is going to be df sub x dx, using the notation kind of loosely, dx, which the notation is loose, there's no way to use it in a tight way. And I kind of snuck in a p there because that's the one we really care about. And you may remember this guy as a gradient of f of x dot a velocity. A gradient dot a velocity gives you the change in the input function as over time. This notation is broken. Once again, we can't tell by looking at this thing what it is. We kind of have to remember that it's a gradient, and then we remember the rules for computing gradients and the rules for computing dot products and so on. We're going to fix the notation so that everything is crystal clear and explicit, and then that's how we're going to relate it to programming. But before fixing it, I'm going to tell you which one is the covariant, which one is the contravariant. You can see, remember at the beginning I said covariance and contravariance implies that you got to have a pair. Well, we have a pair. And it implies something has to be moving. Co and contra means one goes up, the other one goes down. Variance means something is moving. What could be moving here? Nothing's moving. Well, what we're going to move is we're going to change the coordinates from x to y. One of these two buddies is going to change in covariant with the coordinate change, and the other one is going to go contravariant against the coordinate change. And I'm going to show, before we fix the notation, we'll stick with the familiar but broken, I'll show you how to remember which is which. The first big idea is that the answer, the total answer, cannot depend on the choice of coordinates. It does not depend on the fact that I chose lat lon alt for x. I could choose x, y, z, rectangular coordinates. I could choose cylindrical coordinates. I could choose astrometric coordinates. The answer, which is how much fuel do I burn with time, what's the burn rate of fuel over time, that can't depend on the choice of coordinates. In fact, the reason I went through these abstract waypoints in the little table of Belfast and Le Mans and so on is to prove to you it can't change. It doesn't depend in any way on the choice of coordinates. But each one of these buddies does depend on the coordinates. The particular numerical value of this depends very much so on which coordinates you choose, lat lon alt versus rectangular versus cylindrical, whatever, and this guy depends. What we say is the answer, the total, this dot product, is invariant with respect to choice of coordinates, whereas one of these is covariant and one of these is contravariant. But which is which? This is the slippery part. So here's the intuitive way to remember this. Coordinates are numbers that relate to geometry. The geometry is abstract, it's just points on the globe. Let's imagine a change in coordinates, which I've got over here on the slide, but I'll write it over here. Remember this part. Let's imagine that we've moved to some new coordinates y, such that y of p of t is equal to some number a times x of p of t. Our new coordinates are just a numerical factor. We're going to use a numerical factor here so we can develop intuition. And let's imagine that this is a number bigger than 1. Let's just say it's 2. This means that when x is equal to 1, y is equal to 2. When x is equal to 3, y is equal to 6. This means these numbers that y delivers, when you give y a waypoint, oops, I meant to say p of t here. These are both coordinate functions. You give them a waypoint and they give you back some numbers. These numbers are bigger than the x numbers. They're larger. That means, since they relate to geometry, if I'm going from one point to another point, just geometrically, it takes more y's to get there than it takes x's, because the numbers are bigger. Y is a finer-grained coordinate system. The distance between increments in y is narrower because the numbers are bigger. It's kind of backwards. This is the area, just keep in mind, it's all about geometry. Their numbers are relating to geometry. Even though the numbers are bigger, the spacing is finer. Remember that. It's the only thing you need to remember. Now we go back over here. If I change this to a dfdy, it's going to be a slightly different f, an f that knows how to do y's. Remember, the answer cannot depend on the choice of coordinates. Our task is find out which of these two buddies is covariant, which of them is contravariant. If I change to a finer grain coordinate system, the function to give me the same change in the amount of fuel geometrically, the increment in the function has to be less. So when I go to a geometrically finer grain coordinate system, the changes in the function are smaller per unit coordinate. This is the one that co-varies. The numbers are smaller, the delta f's are smaller for a given unit change in the coordinates. If you change delta x by 1, f has to change by so much. If you change delta y by 1, then f has to change less. So it's said to co-vary with the coordinate spacing. Similarly, the velocity contravaries. In order to have the same amount of the same velocity with respect to a geometrical location for a unit time, I have to cover more x's than y's. Let's see if I can show how this is. Over a certain amount of time, my velocity looks like this, and here's my coarse grain coordinate system x, and here's my fine grain coordinate system y. A good way to show this. See, I'm moving a certain geometric distance along this thing, and there's the velocity vector. When the coordinate spacing is finer, the amount that I go in a unit time is more coordinates. So it contravaries. Remember, I said it backwards the first time. This is slippery, but you can recalculate it in your head if you just remember. For a unit change in coordinate, if the coordinates are coarse-grained, the function changes a lot. For a unit change in coordinates, if the coordinates are fine-grained, the function changes a little. That's the covariant buddy. For a unit change in time, if on the coarse-grained coordinate system I don't go very many x's, for the same unit change in time I go a lot more y's. So this number is bigger than this number. This number is smaller than this. Actually, I should draw around the whole thing. This number is smaller than this number. When I go to finer-grained coordinate system, the number is smaller, finer, smaller, covary. this number is bigger than this one. This number is bigger because I do more y's than x's to go the same amount of distance. This one contravaries. Finer grain coordinate system, bigger numbers. One more time just to make sure even I have it right. Coarse grain coordinate system is x. The numbers are bigger. Go to the fine grain coordinate system, the numbers go smaller. Going from the coarse grain to the fine grain coordinate system, the numbers get bigger. Co, small to small. Contra, small to big. Fine grain to bigger numbers. Fine grain to smaller numbers. Whew. It's tricky. We got it, though. All right, now back to the chain rule. This is the one I just did. Okay, that demonstration gives the intuition and the mnemonic. The chain rule gives a precise answer in any number of dimensions and for any kind of coordinate transformations. So we're really going to have to clean up the notation if we're going to be able to use this chain rule for something more complicated than waving our hands. And this is where the transition to very sophisticated physics of all kinds comes in. You go to any number of dimensions, go to curved spaces with all kinds of singularities. The black hole is a singularity. And it gets really, really interesting. Okay. To fix the notation, we have to know exactly what a derivative is. And I'll just state this categorically. You can go look it up in a lot of places. Look for books that say calculus on manifolds, differential geometry, vector calculus. You'll find this. This is the way people are doing things nowadays. A derivative is a linear approximation to a function. Not going to write notation yet. A linear approximation means you give it a small change in inputs, and the linear approximation will give you a small change in outputs that mimic the original function. So if my original function is, I'm going to write our little fuel, x sub p, our little fuel function here. And remember, this is itself a composition of the coordinate system with the waypoint function. So this guy is a function of t. If I had a derivative of this function, I would have another function that's a linear approximation to this function at a particular time. So let's write a derivative. Now I'm going to invent the notation. I'm going to use a squirrely d, a curly d. We used to use this for partial derivative. We'll now just use it to mean derivative. And this is where we have to be careful. This guy is a function of time, and it gives you back the fuel that you have burned at a certain time. This guy, the whole thing, is a linear approximation to this function. To this function. This guy's a function. This guy's a value. This whole thing is a linear approximation to this function at the particular point t. There is a different linear approximation at each point t of the function. So even though these look the same except for a little curly d in the front, they're really different kinds of animals. Here's a function, here's a value. Here's a function. To get a value out of it, I have to give it a little increment in time. And I get back a little increment in the function. I'll write it really small. Okay? Now, what could this guy be? This guy could be a function that takes a t and gives you a linear approximation. That's okay. We can handle that. The curly d introduces one more level of functionness. Curly d takes a function of time and gives you back a function that will give you linear approximations if you give it a time. I hope some of that's clear. We're going to rewrite We're going to look at this original 19th century notation and try to figure out, I'm not going to write it down, it's on the thing. What could this possibly mean? Well, since we now know that a derivative is a linear approximation, we know that this, just as I said before, I'm not even going to write down the 19th century notation, we're going to go straight to the stuff that works. We're going to write the chain rule in a form that asserts an equality on linear approximations. So once again, this guy right here, that's our function, it gives us fuel spent as a function of time. This guy will give us a linear approximation if we give it a time, so we'll give it one. And this guy then is a linear approximation. And what is it equal to? The first thing it's equal to is this guy, just f of x, f sub x alone. This guy has to be a function that if you give it its argument, it will give you back a linear approximation. So we'll give it its argument. We know what its argument is from looking at this thing. You have to give it the particular coordinates of a particular waypoint at a particular time, and then this whole thing will give you a linear approximation. A linear approximation to f sub x. And now rather than proving the chain rule, I'm just writing it in this new form, and the point here is to help you understand these notations that you will see if you go look up any book on calculus and manifolds. This now gets composed with well, this guy has to be something that will give you a linear approximation if you give it a time, give it a time, and we now have a linear approximation to the fuel function at a particular time is the composition of two other linear approximations. Linear approximation one is the linear approximation of the fuel as a function of coordinates at a particular coordinate. That you get from a particular time. Two, a composition with a linear approximation of the path function expressed in coordinates with respect to time. Two, equality of linear approximations. Composition of linear approximations is actually just matrix multiplication in any number of dimensions. If you were just doing real numbers, ordinary one-dimensional calculus, it's multiplication. Composition of linear approximations is multiplication. There's a little paper, by the way, that I'm also distributing with the slides that gives lots of verbiage and a couple of exercises that you can go through to do some calculations in curved spacetime. So there's two materials that will be distributed, these slides and a little paper that goes along with it. Okay, I hope we've got the chain rule because we're now going to use the chain rule. This is, I just did on the board, what this slide says. See, I love it. I'm always getting ahead of my slides. My slides are on a little memory crutch, but my memory still works one ahead. Okay, now we're going to change the coordinates. The little boxes are supposed to be equal signs. I don't know why they turned into boxes, but make sure that's fixed. Now, I'm going to write my old coordinates. Actually, let's write the old coordinates. Remember, we're never going to separate x from p because we don't want to deal with the database-y waypoints. We want to deal with lat, long, and alt. I'm going to define a capital X. This is a coordinate transformation. And if I give it coordinates in some new coordinate system, say cylindrical coordinates or parabolic whatever coordinates, Mercator projection, if I get new coordinates for any point P, I compose it with this capital function capital X and I get back my old coordinates. And this coordinate transformation is going to be invertible. This function capital Y, you give it the old coordinates, it'll give you back the new coordinates. It's B-invertible except for singularities, and this is where the interesting stuff comes in. Spend months and months and months talking about all of those interesting singularities, and if we ever get to black holes, that's what we'll be spending our time on. But accepted singularities, these guys are invertible, And I'll put the buddies over here too. Our old fuel with respect to coordinates. Make sure I get this exactly right. This is going to be Fy composed with y. Let me motivate this for a second here. We'll do a quick calculation, then I'll erase it. F sub x composed with xp has to be equal to F sub y composed with y. I'm going to leave off the brackets, but there they are. I'm testing this definition, composed with xp. But that works. That's F of y composed with little y, because we defined little y as big Y composed with xp. So because of associative law, I can take this, rewrite it like this. This is equal to that. And I've recovered my invariance condition. The fuel burned as a function of time cannot depend on the coordinates. These two guys are equal. So this set of definitions is all self-consistent. And I'll just throw out the one more that you can probably see in your mind. This is F sub x composed with capital X. Now, take a deep breath. Do the chain rule again. Let's write. Remember, we already knew how to calculate the chain rule using the chain rule F sub x. I'm now going to do it with respect to y. Composed with x sub p. Now I'm going to compose it with y sub p. Because I know that F sub x composed with x sub p is the same as F sub y composed with y sub p. So we're going to make sure that these guys are equal. So let's apply the chain rule one time. And we get that this is df sub y sub p of t. I got to have my t here. Knew I was missing something. And in case I make a mistake, you'll see it's right on the slides and in the notes. It's a lot of stuff to write. But that looks right. Derivative of a composition is a composition of derivatives. That's the chain rule. And it's expressed as an equality of linear approximations, which in concrete terms would be an equality of matrices. You do matrix multiplication, all the numbers that come out right, or all the little functions that come out right, and we'd be fine. But now we're going to take this guy and do the chain rule again. I'm going to rewrite this as and it's too early to put the I'm not going to change this here. So the argument is going to stay the same. I'm going to rewrite the function. I'm going to apply the chain rule one more time. Now I just put on the blinders and do the calculation. We're almost done. Did I get that? No, I got to do capital X of Y of P. Oops. Use the bold face Y. One, two, three. Composed with this one, yes, I have to do D capital X. Of course, this is the magic piece right here. D capital X with respect to yp of t. Ooh, look what's happening. Look what's happening. We're getting covariance here. Let me rewrite this. We know what this is. This is little x, bold little x sub p. That was on our original slide. I mean, the stuff I wrote in the board a second ago. Well, look what's happened. This expression in the new coordinates just by rewriting it, I just substituted equals for equals. F sub x compose capital X is the same as F sub y. Has the same form as this, just composed with this extra thing that depends only on coordinates. By changing coordinates, I've unearthed a correction factor. This correction factor, a correction matrix, fixes the values in the old coordinate system so that they equal the values in the new coordinate system. And remember, if y is finer grained, then the numbers in the new coordinate system have to be smaller than the numbers in the old coordinate system. And that's the way that this will work out if you do it. Another way of looking at it is that the x's are here and the x's are here, so that's the covariant guy. Now let's do this one. Y of p, we know, make sure I get it just exactly right, is capital Y composed with X sub p. And this is all just substitute equals for equals. Now drag over the T. Now put on the blinders and do the chain rule again. This is D capital Y at X sub p of t composed with D double strike X little sub p. Oh look, same thing again. This guy in the new coordinates has exactly the same as this guy in the new coordinates, except we've recovered this correction factor that depends only on the change in coordinates. This is fantastic. Look at this. Look at the pattern match here. This guy looks the same as this guy, just changing y for x. And there's this correction factor that depends only on the coordinate systems and the path function. Same way over here. This guy looks just like this guy, only we've got this correction factor that depends on the coordinate systems in the opposite way. Here's the covariant one. Here's the contravariant one. When I go from x to y, this guy goes with the x's. When I change from x to y, this guy goes with the y's. This guy covaries, sticks with the x's. This guy contravaries, goes with the new. Another way to remember it is the covariant correction factors are always on the right, and the contravariant correction factors are always on the left. I don't know if that's all that. Well, left is contra. You know, left is unusual, so it's sort of against the grain. That's a pretty good way of remembering it. And when you turn these things into matrices, you remember that the order of multiplication of matrices is important. Matrix multiplication is not commutative. A times B is not, in general, the same as B times A. So there it is. There are all the secrets of covariance and contravariance laid out bare. And look, another galaxy cluster with gravitational lensing. This is a really great one. This one is Abel 370. I know this one by heart, because I studied Abel clusters when I was in graduate school. And over here, you can see this incredible mess. This is a galaxy, again, behind the coordinate system. The galaxy cluster is curving space and time, and the light coming from this galaxy is getting focused and clarified. Look at the clarity of the stars in there, and it's getting spread out into a string around this sort of lensy structure that's being created by the cluster of galaxies in front of it. Fantastic. By the way, there's a multiple image. The same galaxy is showing up down here. And I bet if we looked around, we could find it in a couple of other places, too. So there you go. That's just the beginning of covariance and contravariance, but that's it for today.